Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
This is Tom Gilson bringing you the second and concluding part of Stephen Meyer's talk at the 2019 Dallas Science and Faith Conference on God and the Origin of the Universe. In part one, Meyer had spoken about Christianity's crucial place in the origin of science and how that's shifted over time to the point where science is dominated now by atheistic materialistic assumptions. We jump in at the 24-minute mark.
The bad news for people of faith is that this materialistic worldview really does dominate the culture now. The elite culture, the universities, many of the elite science research institutions, the law schools, the courts. Students who are of faith know this when they get to those places. They know they got to kind of keep quiet because this is their view is not the dominant view. But there's good news, and that's what I'd like to talk about this morning, and that is that the science of the 19th century that gave rise to this perspective has been eclipsed by major developments in science over the last 100 years in three main areas: cosmology, physics, and biology. Let me talk first about the cosmology or the astronomy. The shift in this field starts in the 1920s. There's a now famous astronomer named Edwin Hubble. Most of us have heard of him because of the famed Hubble telescope. It's kind of a bummer for him because he's a really great scientist. He got a telescope named after him, and it's always broken, and they have to go up there and fix it. But anyway, Hubble starts working in the 20s. He comes out of law, the field of law, into astronomy at a really propitious time. They're building these great dome telescopes. This is the 100-inch diameter telescope at Mount Wilson that Hubble used. And using these great big telescopes, the astronomers are able to, at this time, to start resolving these onto photographic plates, the light coming from little tiny, distant, previously indistinct points of light in the night sky. And it turns out that these little indistinct points, once the light is collected over with a long exposure on a photographic plate through these big telescopic lenses, the light starts revealing structure. And this is a picture of what's called a spindle nebula. And there were others, spiral nebulas, and, that's a spiral, and here's another spiral nebula. Now, this reignited a debate that had been going on in astronomy between astronomers who thought that our Milky Way galaxy was the only galaxy, and other astronomers who thought that there were other galaxies beyond the Milky Way, island universes, if you will, beyond the Milky Way. And this was called the Great Debate in the 1920s. But in 1924, Hubble was able to settle this debate by using some new techniques for estimating distances. He was able to determine that the Andromeda Nebula was actually the Andromeda Galaxy, that it was a separate galaxy. And the way he was able to show that is he was using these new techniques for measuring distances. He determined that the Andromeda Galaxy, one of the closest ones to us, is 900,000 light years away. That was his estimate at the time. And the astronomers thought at the time the Milky Way was only 300,000 light years across. So clearly it had to be way beyond the Milky Way. Therefore, it was a separate galaxy, and the Andromeda Nebula, which just meant gas cloud, was renamed the Andromeda Galaxy. That was pretty awesome. And as they began to look at other points of light using these same techniques, they found that there were galaxies in every direction of the night sky. In fact, if you look at this little square that's highlighted on the PowerPoint, that's like a little tiny part of the visual field, maybe like a dime at arm's length. And now if we were to magnify that, it reveals galaxies galore in even the tiniest little quadrant of the night sky. And the current estimate is that there are about 200 billion galaxies in the visible universe. So in just the space of a decade, our sense of the immensity of the universe was just magnified incredibly. Now, that was really an amazing discovery, but even more important was what was discovered as a result of the light coming from these galaxies. Turns out that the light was redder than the scientists expected. You know how if you shine light through a prism and it separates into colors, the red through to the blue and the violet? And the red light has a long wavelength. And if an object is emitting light and moving away, it will cause the wavelength of the light to stretch out, and it will look redder than it would otherwise look. So the light coming from the gases in these faraway galaxies looked redder than similar light would look coming from if we looked at it in the spectra in a laboratory. And they call this the red shift. In other words, the wavelength was stretched out. It's kind of like the Doppler shift with sound. When if a train whistle goes by, it goes the sound. Well, that's the wavelength of the sound stretching out. The same thing happens with light. And so the scientists were able to discern that the galaxies are actually moving away from us. That's what the red shift meant. Now, that had incredible implications for the question of the origin of the universe itself. Hubble used data from an unsung hero in astronomy named Vesto Slipher about this red shift. And so here's the implication of all this. If the galaxies are moving away from us in every direction, in the forward direction of time, the only way that could be true is if there is a kind of spherically symmetric expansion of the universe, that everything is expanding in the forward direction. So
here Meyer begins blowing up a balloon, then later when he speaks of back extrapolating, you can hear him letting air out of it.
So if we think of, I got a visual aid. In the forward direction of time, you have the universe getting bigger, bigger and bigger, and the galaxies, every galaxy getting further and further away from every other galaxy. But if you wind the time clock backwards, if you back extrapolate, and you think, well, what was the universe like 100 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, or 1,000,000, or 1,000,000,000, or however far back you go, eventually you get to the point where all that galactic material is going to congeal or would have come back to the same point, a point marking the beginning of the expansion of the universe and arguably the beginning of the universe itself. And so we have, from observational astronomy, the first hint that the universe has not been here eternally. It's not eternal and self-existent, but rather it had a beginning. This is one of Hubble's plots showing that there was a law. The further out the galaxies are, the faster they're moving away. And that, again, can only be true if the universe is expanding in this spherically symmetric way. Now, about this time, actually a little before this time, there is a famous physicist with really bad hair who had come to a very similar conclusion. And this was Albert Einstein. He was in the 19-teens, still working in Germany. Eventually, he came to Princeton to escape the Nazis. But in the teens, he came up with another theory, a new theory of gravity known as general relativity. And we talked a little bit about this last night, but it's basically the conceptual idea behind it is that matter causes space to bend such that other matter passing through that space will have its motion changed by that preferred lines of trajectory. So as a result of this, he's thinking, well, if matter causes space to bend, then that means that if all you have in the universe is that gravitational field, then everything should be collapsed onto itself into something like a black hole. But we don't live in a universe like that. We live in a universe where there's massive bodies separated by empty space. So there must be some countervening force of expansion to offset the gravitational force, which means that the universe must be in some way dynamic. There's something pushing outward. But if something's pushing outward, then that it would imply that there could have been a beginning. And that troubled Einstein. Because at this point in his career, it was different later, but at this point in his career, he was very much a scientific materialist. And so he posited something. It was kind of a fairly arbitrary conjecture on his part, but he proposed that this outward pushing force, which he called the cosmological constant, had exactly the right magnitude so that the outward push was exactly balanced by the gravitational pull, and you had a universe that was static, neither expanding nor contracting. It was kind of a contrived value that he assigned to this, but it worked to eliminate the idea of a beginning. And for a time, for him, that was a sigh of relief. But then in the 20s, other physicists started working with these equations, and they realized, you know, that's pretty contrived, Einstein. That would be an incredible degree of fine-tuning to have that cosmological constant with exactly the value that you, Einstein, chose for it. The math allows a lot of other values that would imply, most other values would imply a dynamic universe. That's thing one. And then this amazing physicist, a Belgian Catholic priest named Father Lemaître, is with Einstein at a conference in the 20s. And they're in a taxi cab ride going to the conference. And Lemaître tells Einstein, first of all, your physics is contrived. The equations really suggest a dynamic universe. You know it and we know it. But also, have you heard about this redshift data that Hubble's working with out in California? Because it's showing that the dynamic expanding universe is really what, you know, the heavens have talked back effect, in effect. And Einstein was listened to Lemaître and eventually made his way out at Hubble's invitation to Pasadena, California, and had a peek for himself through the Hooker 100-inch telescope, and came out and announced to the media after seeing this in his heavy German accent, he came out and said, "I now see the necessity of a beginning." And later and explained that the value, this arbitrary value he chose for the cosmological constant, was the greatest mistake of his scientific career, because he allowed his philosophical presuppositions, his predilections, to determine his scientific theory rather than letting the evidence decide the question. And anyways, a great moment in the history of science. It established what is now known as the Big Bang Theory, when you have this convergence of theoretical physics, general relativity, with observational astronomy, and that in turn established that the universe had a beginning. Now, Einstein was not the only scientist at the time who didn't like this. Sir Arthur Eddington, a famous British astrophysicist, said this. He said, "Philosophically, the notion of a beginning of the present order is repugnant to me. I should like to find a genuine loophole. I simply do not believe the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous. It leaves me cold," he said. This in psychology is known as the theory of denial. You notice what the evidence he's citing? He's not citing it. He says, philosophically, he doesn't like it. And later physicists, you know, because you have to ask, well, what's the big deal? Why are physicists so upset about the idea of a beginning? Princeton physicist Robert Dickey put it this way. He said, an infinitely old universe would relieve us of the necessity of explaining the origin of matter at any finite time in the past. If matter itself comes into existence, then you can't invoke matter as the cause of the origin of the material universe. You need something that is immaterial, that transcends matter. And this conclusion was highlighted later in the 1960s by some work by Stephen Hawking. There's a bigger story here that I'm compressing, and maybe with Guillermo, we can talk a bit more about it. After the Big Bang was proposed, there were some other models proposed, the steady state model, the oscillating universe model. These were each attempts to preserve an infinite universe that didn't have a beginning. But one by one, as more observations of different kinds came online in astronomy, these were set aside as inadequate theories. And then in the mid-60s, there was an extraordinary development in theoretical physics. Stephen Hawking, probably know of him, wonderful, inspiring figure. You know, the physicist confined to a wheelchair with the ALS disease. When he's working as a PhD student, he's working on black hole physics. And he's aware of the way that, you know, matter causes this, the space to curve. And he begins to think, and that's what he's thinking, okay, that's what's going on with the black hole. There's so much matter, it's curved so tightly, you can't get anything out. But he starts to apply this idea to the universe, and he's realizing that as the universe is going forward in time, matter's getting more and more dispersed. But as you wind that clock backwards again in your mind's eye, you eventually get to the point where the matter is so tightly curved, or the matter is so densely compact that space is getting tighter and tighter, more tightly curved in its curvature, and eventually the mathematics, something called the field equations of general relativity, which he and Roger Penrose solved, imply that there is an infinite curvature at some point in the finite past. Now, an infinite curvature corresponds to zero spatial volume, and then you have to ask what we discussed last night, how much stuff can you put in no space? And the answer is, well, no things go in no space. I mean, this singularity theorem has this profoundly anti-materialistic implication. And it happens that Hawking worked for much of the rest of his life to try to, as W.C. Fields put it, he was looking for a loophole. You know, he was looking for a way around this conclusion. Hawking was a really interesting figure. He was a kind of theologically sensitive, even you could say God-obsessed atheist. And so he was aware of what he'd shown in 1968 with Penrose, but then he was developing other ideas, one called quantum cosmology, which we can discuss in the Q&A, and which I discuss at length in my new book, trying to find a way around this conclusion. But the straightforward application of general relativity to the origin of the universe implies a creation event. And we'll have a little quiz on these equations afterwards. But anyway, this is the idea that curvature goes to an infinite, zero spatial volume. The astronomer Robert Jastrow said, this is an exceedingly strange development, unexpected by all but the theologians. He's writing in the 80s. Notice our starting point. Remember my starting point with Dawkins? He said that the universe is exactly as we should expect if there's nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. But these astronomers are saying, no, this is totally unexpected from a materialistic standpoint, but it was expected by the theologians. And Jastrow went on to say, for the scientist who's lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He scaled the mountains of ignorance, he's about to conquer the highest peak, and as he pulls himself up over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. Entirely expecting that the universe would have a beginning, because after all, in the biblical witness, you had the very first words are, in the beginning. Arno Penzias, one of the leading physicists who played a big role in this story in refuting what's called the steady state theory with his work on what's called the cosmic background radiation, put it this way. He said, the best data we have concerning the Big Bang are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. And indeed, it is rather striking. The first words of the Bible are in the beginning. In the epistles in the New Testament, there are two different mentions of the plan of God existing before the beginning of time, which is really striking in light of relativity theory, because the singularity theorem implies that time itself is a created entity which has a beginning. And there's even mentions, 11 or 12 separate mentions in the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, of God stretching out the heavens, either having stretched or stretching out the heavens. So this new cosmology is in a way very much expected on this, from the standpoint of theism. It also helps revive an ancient argument for the existence of God that went like this. Everything that begins to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist, and the universe therefore must have a cause separate from itself. All causes are separate from their effects. We call that transcendent or separate cause God. Now, I developed this argument in a little different way in my new book on the return of the God hypothesis, using a method of reasoning known as inference to the best explanation, where if you have an historical event, you try to explain it by reference to all the possible causes you could consider, and then you examine those causes to see which one are causally adequate or sufficient to explain the effect, and if you find causes that aren't sufficient, you one by one eliminate them, and in the best case, you elect that one cause which has the powers or is known to produce the effect in question. What I've done in the book is I apply this not to scientific hypotheses, but to the different worldview hypotheses with respect to the origin of the universe. I look at materialism, and materialism has this problem. If matter itself comes into existence a finite time ago in the past, then there's no matter before that to do the causing. It's an inadequate cause. It's not causally adequate. Pantheism has the same problem because it equates God and matter. It says that God is in all the material things around us. That's the Eastern philosophy. But and God and matter are coextensive. So before there was matter, there was the material universe had a beginning. Before that, there was neither matter nor God. And so pantheism also lacks a cause separate from the universe that could bring it into existence. It lacks transcendence. Theism, on the other hand, posits a God that's independent of the universe and therefore can provide a causally adequate explanation for the origin of the universe from something else, because there is a something else. There's a transcendent entity of great power who could bring the universe into existence. It happens that deism also posits a transcendent entity. And as we talked about last night, the question between deism and theism would be, is there any evidence of design after the beginning of the universe? But both deism and theism could account for the origin of the universe in my reckoning. And so applying this method, we end up with something like this, a God hypothesis of some kind. Now, In my book, and Jay will talk a bit more about the fine-tuning, but there are always counter-arguments to good theistic arguments. And one of the ways you assess how good an argument is how well it sustains its strength in the face of counter-arguments or critique. And one of the big counter-arguments today against this cosmological argument that I'm developing is Hawking's new idea that he developed after the singularity theorem called quantum cosmology. And that's just the idea that the laws of, that when the universe is very small, quantum physics can describe the universe in that early state, and those quantum laws would make our universe in some way expected. And he has a famous quotation from the last major book he published before he died, where he says, because there is a law such as gravity, and he's talking about a law of quantum gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists and why we exist. Now, there's a whole lot to say about this. I get into this in great detail in the new book, and we'll talk about it in the Q&A if you'd like as well. But you can see just from this quotation, there's a fundamental confusion underlying this whole enterprise. Hawking was a great physicist and a subpar philosopher. And this is just really bad philosophy. The laws of physics describe what matter and energy do in relation to each other once you have them. They don't describe where matter and energy come from. Okay, they describe what matter and energy do, what stuff does, but they don't explain where stuff came from. So this is what you call a category error, and it runs all the way through Hawking's work on quantum cosmology, as well as popularizers like Lawrence Krauss's. So we can talk more about that in the Q&A. I discuss all of this in my new book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, but I think you can see just in conclusion that Dawkins's bold assertion that the universe looks as we would expect from the standpoint of a materialistic worldview is patently false. It looks exactly as we would expect from a theistic point of view, and people have to come up with really abstract cosmological, speculative cosmological ideas like quantum cosmology and multiverses to get around things like the fine-tuning and the evidence for a definite beginning to the universe.
This has been part two of a talk Stephen Meyer gave at the 2019 Dallas Science and Faith Conference, a talk that draws on the subject of his upcoming book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, Compelling Evidence for the Existence of God. You can pre-order Meyer's newest book at a steep discount by going to Amazon and searching for Return of the God Hypothesis. Check it out and reserve your copy of the book today. For ID the Future, this is Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.